Hi everyone, and thanks for listening to Lit Radio Podcast. I'm Thea, and today I'm joined by Steven D'Souza. We will talk about his latest book, Shadows at Work: Harness Your Dark Side and Unlock Your Leadership Potential. Steven is an award-winning author, executive educator, trusted advisor, leadership coach, and keynote speaker. He has spoken globally to organizations such as PwC, TikTok, Financial Times, and the United Nations. His work has been featured in Harvard Business Review, The Independent, and The Sunday Times. Shadows at Work is about the parts of ourselves we repress and push into the unconscious. To lead effectively and live fully, we must face, embrace, and integrate these hidden aspects not only in the workplace, but in all areas of life. Hi, Steven. It's a great pleasure to have you with us on Lit Radio Podcast. How are you today?
Yes, very well, Thea. Glad to be a guest and to talk about the new book with Lit.
Absolutely. And I'm also very excited to speak with you about that. So my first question is, how you decided to write the book, Shadows at Work?
To answer that, I think I would answer on three levels. One is the personal reason I wrote it, and then the professional reason, and then just maybe macro observations on society and why I thought this book was relevant. So from a personal standpoint, I also share this in the book. Like, all the books I write are not from expertise or pretending to be some authority on the topic, but they're written from my own curiosity and my own struggles with the topic. So the same with Not Knowing, which is a trilogy, you know, it was my struggle with not knowing that led to that inquiry. So the book on shadows is really my own personal inquiry into how do I understand my own shadows? How do I understand my own repetitive behavior? You know, that might be self-sabotage, for example. How might I think about issues around ethical leadership? Why might I struggle with guilt, with shame, with human emotions that might be repetitious or not necessarily supporting behavior change? So I grew up in a very Catholic family, and religion was quite important to me. And I trained initially as a priest. So this also brought in issues around light, dark, good, bad, that were important for me to make sense of and explore. I was sponsored by the prison service in the United Kingdom on a leadership program. And in my summers, I worked in a young offenders prison with boys who were 15 years old, 16 years old, but were there for murder, robbery, and rape, and very serious crimes. But I got to see, you know, what is it? Is there such a thing as a really bad individual? Or what is the context between responsibility and influence by their upbringing and by their own conditions? And lastly, I've always been interested in the hidden side of things and what we don't privilege. So I grew up as a minority ethnic community in a predominantly white council estate. And I was sensitive, I think, to issues around inclusion and diversity. So when I wanted to explore Not Knowing, it was about exploring the hidden aspects or what we don't normally put energy on. So, for example, we put energy on knowledge, but not on curiosity or what we don't know. So this book in the shadow is almost like looking at what are we not putting energy on? We're putting energy on the positive leadership, for example, and the traits, but we don't necessarily spend time inquiring on what we don't want to look at and what's in the background, the shadow, as it were. So that was on the personal side. On the professional side, I've spent my whole career in consulting and in leadership development, working with hundreds of leaders and hundreds of companies across the globe. And for me, like, one of the things that is interesting to me is, you know, why do leaders derail? Like, but when they're taking on a new job, for example, executives, between 50 to 70% of them derail within the first 18 months. So why is that? Why do we sometimes don't succeed? And what is it that sabotages our success? And then I noticed that in organizations where I felt, you know, they were classified as, let's say, nefarious or negative organizations, let's say in industries like tobacco, or and I said, why are the cultures, in my experience, sometimes more open, sometimes more positive than cultures in charities and NGOs, which discovered were very toxic? How do I explain and understand that paradox? So I wanted to understand, what is it in organizations that can create cultures that allow shadow behaviors to happen or prevent it? And what is it that is happening within those organizations? And the third reason was looking at society. Like there's some commentators that have described the period we're living now as the dark mode shift, meaning that in the last decade or so, it was very positive. You know, it was about progress on climate change, progress in D&I, globalization, but we're sort of seeing a reverse of that. You know, we're seeing attention on these subjects being peeled back. We're seeing more division, more conflict, at least more public and overt. So we're feeling more anxious now. Whether that's the case, you know, authors like Steven Pinker have argued for progress, but the lived experience, at least mine, is of more division and more polarity. And I think that this topic of looking at the shadow holds a key into how do we unlock the polarization? How do we move towards a more integrated and whole society as well? I talk about at the beginning of the book, an English composer called Michael Tippett, who was 93 when he died, but he wrote a really beautiful libretto, a piece called A Child of Our Time, in the aftermath of the Second World War. And he said, I shall know my shadow and my light, and therefore I shall be whole. But he points to the fact that we're not able to confront our shadows as a reason why perhaps they can spill and cause the destructive behaviors that we see in society. So part of it is looking at what can we do to actually, as leaders, to change that situation and to contribute something positive towards that change. So that's probably the three main reasons I wrote the book: the personal, the professional, and I think its relevance societally.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. I think the book is very important and yeah, very timely at the moment. But before we speak more about that, could you tell us a bit more about the writing process for you? Because you're also an award-winning author, and obviously we've listened to some people who might be thinking of writing a business book. So what was it like to write this book?
This is the sixth book I've written, and all of them are different. In the past, I've worked with co-authors, and I've also written books alone. This process took me quite a few years because for me, it was a challenging subject to bring to a business audience. So if one does a cursory look at the topic of the shadow, just on Amazon or on a book depository, etc., you'll find many books on shadow work, but it tends to be more psychological, and it tends to be based on inner child and often framed in a New Age type of, or like a more of a spiritual, quasi-spiritual, psychological lens. And what I wanted to do was very different, make the topic relevant for those in the world of work. So that the challenge in this book was that thinking process, and how do I frame it in a way that's useful to those in the world of work and not necessarily requiring beliefs and taking on more deeper psychological work at least to explore the topic. So that took me a long time to try to get the frames, how I would approach the topic. The actual writing, you know, part of it is working with a good editor. So Shadows at Work would say I work closely with my editor, who helped put into words what I was trying to express and helped augment and challenge me in terms of thinking, you know, what are the relevant case studies. So in this book, it's less full of stories, like the Not Knowing Trilogy, but more formed of literary examples and cultural examples, particularly taking them from modern day films, let's say like The Talented Mr. Ripley, for example, or Living, or the film Perfect Days by Wim Wenders. So what I wanted to do was to make the topic relatable and accessible. So that took its time. But now I always say that if I put down an idea, it's very messy, and I'm definitely not proud of it. And it's working with a great editor who helps turn that straw into gold, or at least much better than me working alone. And so that was vital to the process of this book.
Yeah, absolutely. Having a good team behind you is always a huge help.
Yes.
Okay, so let's go back to the book and discuss its content and key messages. So first of all, could you share what are the shadows at work?
It's a good question. As I mentioned in the last answer, we tend to think mostly of the shadow through the psychological lens. So listeners or viewers may be familiar with the shadow as a concept from Carl Jung, the psychologist who really made it into popular discourse. And he talked about the shadow being almost like the repressed or the invisible parts of us that, because of our conditioning, perhaps our childhood or social messages from our culture, that those parts of us were deemed unacceptable. And they were put into our unconscious and out of our awareness. So, for example, if I was told, you know, don't be such a show-off, you know, I may have put my energy that was of that presenter energy of that in, and I may put it in and close it off because I didn't want to have the disapproval of something that, you know, was not safe to feel or safe to express. And that's one of the key ideas of the shadow. It's like this, it's this repository of what we weren't able to express or to acknowledge or to feel. And normally that became because of some form of relational where it was not accepted. And so that's the definition of shadow most people are really aware of. The simple way to think about it is the me that I don't see. You know, it's the part of you that you're not conscious of, but perhaps those who work with you, those who are in some form of relationship with you, they see it, but you're not aware of it. And so that's the first thing. You know, you had this idea, and it was built upon by other psychologists of a persona or mask. So there's this mask that we present, or the persona that we present to the world, but underneath that is the shadow. So, and the shadow is always present, and it can disrupt and derail us. And that's why we sometimes do things and we're not conscious why, but they happen. So there's a lovely quote. People aren't sure if it's attributed to Jung, but it's, if until we make the unconscious conscious, we will call it fate, and it will direct our lives. So the point of it is to raise awareness of what is there. Now, it's not only individual, there are collective shadows. He called it the collective unconscious. So these can happen in cultures, in organizations, in countries, in different times. So there are things that aren't being expressed, but are there, almost like the opposite or the polarity of what we put energy on. So one of my friends, a psychotherapist, used to say, if you want to know what the shadows are of a company, just look at what they value. So if they say integrity, what happens to those people who are not in compliance with that integrity or other values? So it's almost like the opposite exists, but where is that and how is it expressed? Is it overt or is it really hidden and covert? So that collective unconscious that can happen. And normally if that's not dealt with, it can result in things like scapegoating, putting on what society doesn't want to grapple with onto groups and make scapegoats. We may see this in, you know, the hatred of the foreigner, for example, who might be a scapegoat. So that's the psychological and the social aspects of the shadow. And I look at both psychology and society or culture, and both are important because shadow isn't individual only, it's relational, and therefore it comes into relationships systemically. And the two others I look at are biology. So this idea that we're not just minds, we're embodied beings, and that our physiology, our genetics, our biology, our hunger, Anger, tiredness, aloneness can result in shadow behavior. So in Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, they have the acronym HALT, HALT. So they say, before you take a drink, ask yourself, are you hungry, angry, lonely, or tired? And they've shown that people who work, without sleep tend to make decisions that they wouldn't normally make and resulting in bad faith actions because of that. The last lens I look at is the spiritual lens. So in many societies, this idea of the shadow is something that is not necessarily negative, but is an essential part of maturity. So in Christianity, for example, there's this idea of the dark night of the soul. So it means that, it's not always about the light and the joy, but we become purified or we become more whole by confronting, a period of desolation in our lives, a period of lack of meaning. But we emerge from that place more thoughtful, more stronger, more compassionate. In Taoism, for example, they have this symbol that many people have seen of the yin and the yang, the light and the dark. But in each of the spheres, there's a bit of the opposite. And this almost means that, part of shadow work is recognizing the light in our darkness, but also the darkness within our light. And it's being a more whole and a more balanced human being because of that recognition, the ability to hold opposites and to hold them together rather than to separate them and to bifurcate. So that's the way I understand the shadow. And in the book, I look at practical things like how does it operate through projection? How might it happen that defensiveness, for example, how might the shadow derail us? What does it mean when we have technology? How can we remain embodied? And lastly, this idea of how does it affect our life or our career? So those are the lenses I explore the shadow with.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting that you look at shadows from so many different lenses. And you've touched on that a little bit, but are shadows always negative or can they be positive?
No, it's a great question here because we always mostly assume that they're negative because they've got a connotation of being dark. And yet, shadow just means hidden. It doesn't mean negative. So if something's in the dark, it doesn't mean it's negative. So Jung talked about this idea of the golden shadow, meaning that sometimes our gifts, let's example, our creativity, may have been put into the shadows. We may not have expressed it. Think of that example I gave you earlier. So the shadow is a shadow work is about reclaiming what's hidden, and it's not about necessarily the negative. And often our wounds and the suffering that we've been through in our lives as part of all human lives can act as almost like gifts. When allowed to be expressed. So you can, this a common example is Oprah Winfrey. She had a very tough childhood, talked about sexual abuse and she played the character in the Color Purple film, really honing that. But when she came to do her talk show, she wasn't, what made her so successful wasn't the polished elocute that she was, but it was also her ability to deeply empathize, have compassion with her guests and to harness her the vulnerability to make a really like compelling connection with those that she hosted on her show. So this idea of the golden shadow is also there. A metaphor I like is of a mansion with many rooms. We tend to live, let's say, from three or four rooms. Let's call them our default ways of being. But there are many more rooms in the house. There might be things that you haven't opened and rooms that you haven't explored. And some may be really vital to you living a life with more energy, more gusto, more joy. And so shadow work is about reclaiming more of yourself, maybe leaving less rooms unopened and being able to feel a bit more totally alive rather than, let's say, living a smaller life.
Absolutely. And I think that's very interesting because, as you say, when you say shadow, a lot of people they think of the dark, of the negatives, when in reality, that's not that may not be true. And Stephen, why is it so difficult for us as individuals to recognize our own shadows?
Yeah, it's a good question again, because it's really hard, because they're hidden, they're unconscious. So unlike the persona that we present to the world and others can see, we aren't aware of our shadows. And they, you know, so normally they come out, and by ways that we really need to hunt for them, and we need to search for them. So, for example, I talk about triggers. So let's say you have a conflict with somebody, and whatever they say, you notice that you're triggered, but you're not triggered because of what they said. You notice that your reaction is stronger. It's almost disproportionate to the situation, and something is going on beyond what they said, you know, that's deeper. And so it's almost like a process of discovery, that we discover our shadows through paying attention to what is happening that isn't helpful for us. So I gave the example of overreacting, and maybe that's you're discovering, oh, there might be something else going on. Another way to discover our shadows is by noticing when we keep on doing the same thing and repeating the same pattern. It might be with a different person each time, but there's a repetition and there's a repeating of something that we don't want. And we keep on derailing. Just when we're going to be successful, something happens and that relationship is broken, or that job is lost, or, you know, that argument happens just when we're repairing it. So, you know, something is on a loop, as it were, and we're repeating it. So those are the two practical ways to recognize when we might be operating from shadows. Another way is through feedback. So, you know, it's asking for feedback and thinking, you know, looking actively for what you're not able to see. So it's that humility that's interrogating our own beliefs and our own opinions, and being able to accept contrarian opinions, that maybe we don't look so good, you know, by what somebody says. But are we able to hold their opinion and their insight, and allows us to see something that we're not able to see? So one of my teachers used to say, if you want to know why somebody does what they do, they are the last person to ask, because you think they know the answers, but because they may not, because it's in their shadow. So it's often the people around that are better able to see the shadows. So that's the importance of, for example, 360-degree appraisals in companies. But it's also the vital reason that we have to keep that beginner's mind, or that open mind, to stay curious and to be open to accepting, you know, feedback that may be conflictual with our own story and our own identity. So those are the main things there.
Yeah, very interesting. I think some really good tips on how to actually understand and recognize our own shadows, which it could be a great help. Right, and then the last chapter of your book, Stephen, is titled Living the Shadow Life. So what do you mean by that?
Yes, so I didn't want only want shadows to be applied to aspects at work, but it wanted to look at this idea that, you know, we at some point, we come, and sometimes it's mostly at midlife, you know, we come to this idea of, have I been living the life that I wanted to live? And we reflect back on our choices. You know, am I in the right career? Am I in the right relationship? Am I doing the right thing in my professional life? And this idea of the shadow life is the unlived life. It's this life that I didn't express because of my choices. You know, and I'm not saying that we could have chosen differently. We chose based on our priorities at the time, or societal expectations, etc. But there's something unlived, and there's something that might still be alive. And normally we can feel that, maybe with a sense of regret. And people, you know, they can express shadow lives by watching movies, or people who play characters, or that I always wanted to be a pilot, for example, but I never had the skills to, but I might enjoy watching air movies or racing, whatever that happens to be. Now, you know, in my own life, for example, I applied to be a school teacher many times, and I was always drawn to teaching as a profession, but each time I didn't know to take it. And I think probably because There were two reasons. One is because I didn't feel that it was a well-paid profession, considering how important it is. And I think my valued income more, and I'm just being honest because I have my own shadows around money, which is also a topic. But also because I felt, am I going to make a difference really? Because of the political pressure placed on teachers, on the curriculum, the emphasis on testing rather than on learning, which is, you know, more holistic, that I wanted to explore. So I had this idea of the shadow career almost. I could have been a teacher. Now, you know, looking at what I do now, I'm expressing the same things, but maybe not with as many young people as I would have liked. But there's also a time that, you know, we may not be able to undo what decisions we made in the past, but we can maybe revisit them and get the spirit of what was wanting to be expressed in the present and going forward. So, for example, Lucy Calloway from the Financial Times set up an organization called Teach Now, which was not aimed at graduates, but was aimed at professionals who could come back in later career and be a school teacher, let's say in inner city schools. And they have more to share because they've got professional experience, they've got knowledge of the world of work that they can really contribute to their students. So it's not as if I have to say no to that energy that was there, but how can I express it differently? There's some beautiful films that I talk about in the chapter. One is a film called Living, which was originally a Japanese film called Ikaru, where this bureaucrat was working and almost like a paper pusher. And very, you know, his life was always the same. He discovers he has cancer. And this shifts his whole attitude to his life, where suddenly he invests in helping a local community make a playground for their children. But it's almost like his whole life shifted and changed, and in reflection on his own mortality. Second film called Perfect Days by Wenders. It's a beautiful film that follows a main character who's a cleaner of public toilets in Tokyo, and you think it's such a, you know, not a high profile job compared to the character's sister who's driving a Mercedes. But the film looks at how he finds simplicity, how he finds joy, how he finds contemplation in each moment. So shadow life and career is an invitation to a reflection of what do we really care about in our lives? What does success mean to us beyond the messages that we might get around what it constitutes in society that's more an achievement-orientated society? And how might we choose to live differently, confronting what we've been disappeared in our lives till now? So, yes, I wanted to take on that more macro perspective in exploring the topic of the shadow.
I think that's very interesting. And obviously, I would encourage our listeners to read more in that chapter because, it's a very, very insightful part of the book. But now, let's switch our focus to leadership. And earlier we spoke about how we can recognize our shadows and some practical advice on how to do it. But when you're a leader, in many cases, a lot of people depend on you, and it might not be so easy to ask other people to show you what your shadows are, because they might not feel confident enough to share that with you. So, when you're a leader, how can you become aware of your shadows? And I think probably the more important question, how to work on them?
Yes, it's excellent because we're not really taught how to do this. You know, the higher you become a leader, the less people are truthful with you because of the power dynamic. So we see a big movement now, basing on Amy Edmondson's work about the importance of leaders creating psychological safety, encouraging candid opinions and contrarian opinions to their own. Simple devices like, you know, sharing their opinion last rather than sharing their opinion first, which can influence those in meetings. So that ability to have humility by sharing what they don't know and what they all do rather than always having the answers. So these are important signals that leaders can take. I think having a person or team or individuals that can be truth tellers for them is important. So, you know, in the past, in the medieval ages, the fool played that role of saying the truth, and they would be accepted. Often they met painful deaths, but they would be accepted as if they could get away with saying anything. Well, you could think of the child in the emperor's new clothes. But leaders normally have, you know, a couple of people that they, and they may not be senior people, but they can tell them, they can call them in the organization to find out what's really happening. And they can trust that these people will be candid to them. So one of the first companies I worked for was a hotel chain. And the founder of the company would call this woman called Beverly. She wasn't at the top of the organization, but he would call her on Saturdays to see what is really going on in the company. What do I need to know of? How are people feeling? And this is critical to have that kind of one or two people that can give them the honest feedback. I think also having people like a coach, somebody that isn't in the system and that can hear, you know, the concerns and give feedback without any vested interest and or political interest in any outcome is important. So leveraging a good coach that can listen, but that can also challenge and is paid to challenge is super important. So if you don't get that in your management team by, you know, encouraging healthy conflict and disagreement, I think it's good to have somebody who's an advisor or a coach to be that third person to speak truth to power outside of the domains. So the psychological safety, the encouraging of contrarian opinions. And I'd say a third one is the inner work that every leader needs to do. They'll be on the receiving end of projections. We call it, you know, projective identification. It might be the hero, it may be the villain. But in either case, it's more to do with the followers and what their expectations are. So leaders can't ignore that they're going to be projected on. They need to recognize what are the projections, and they need to be able to work with those projections rather than pretend that they're not there. So a lot of work I think leaders need to do in, I would say, that could benefit from deep psychodynamic work or therapeutical work or coaching and mentoring to help them deal with this and to help manage their own relationship with their own shadows. So we have seen recently, but through time, many derailers, for example, the CEO of Nestle resigning, or the astronomer CEO caught on a Coldplay concert. And part of it is not necessarily only looking at the individual, because obviously that individual made choices. And there's a lot of issues around power, not just around sex, but power too, and how that could be misused. But there's also systemic issues, like how do organizations ensure that power isn't misused? How do you have a culture where people can speak up, and when they do, that they're listened to? So it goes beyond thinking of only bad faith actors, but what is in the culture that enables and supports that kind of behavior too. So leaders need to pay attention to that. And I think organizations need to spend more time understanding the shadow rather than just focusing on the light and positive leadership of things that, you know, we already know are helpful. But we need to look at what we don't want to look at, and we need to confront, let's say, hidden dynamics that are also at play.
Absolutely. And what are the benefits when leaders become aware of their shadows and then they work on improving them? Yeah, what happens with their leadership?
I'd say there'll be less derailment. So leaders won't necessarily be repeating the same patterns that might put them at risk. I think there'll be benefits for customers and employees. So let's say a leader's unconsciously acting out favoritism or unconsciously favoritizing a department over other. By bringing that out into the open, you know, it'll be more meritocratic, egalitarian. Toxicity would be less. It's particularly, let's say, that the leader's casting a toxic shadow. Many people leave jobs not because of the job itself, but because of the manager, the culture, and the environment. So there'll be less of that. You know, I think I was reading an estimate like 350 billion is in the UK is lost due to, you know, lack of engagement, and predominantly from managers who are toxic, you know, creating toxic cultures. because ultimately leaders shape the culture. I also think that they'll feel more energy and more vitality by engaging with their shadow. They'll have to be less defensive, less needing to have it right, and more able to work with their teams and with the organization. So these, I think, are some of the benefits: less scapegoating, less derailment, more energy, and I think more authenticity, because if they're not having to be perfect, they can be a bit more relatable, a bit more vulnerable. It's not a performative or authenticity where they're just doing it as an act of show, but it's genuine, and people want to follow them because they will be liked for being human rather than for being, just an image that people can't relate to and don't want to follow.
Yeah, absolutely. And all of that really showed the importance of doing the work.
Mm.
Okay, Simon, so I have just one final question for you to end this really fascinating conversation. So what's your goal with the book Shadows at Work? What would you like, what role would you like the book to play in your readers' lives?
I'd like the book to help readers feel more alive, more accepting of their own humanity, rather than thinking that they need to be perfect. So a big part of the book is this idea that we all have shadows. We will all derail. We all are defensive. We're often disembodied, and we all have regrets. And part of that is not to pretend that they aren't there and to be ashamed of them, but to recognize that, that's what makes me human. And that's what, being a good leader is about. It's being able to confront, being able to face, being able to work with our shadows. So my hope is that shadow work isn't seen as something that's only deeply psychological and about inner child work. It is, because our childhood does influence us, can influence us greatly, but it's more than that. And it's something about not just looking at the why, but looking at the how. How does the shadow operate? And as a leader, if I want to live a life that's more rich, a life that's more whole, how might I benefit from the looking at the shadow work? So that's my hope, that it leaves the reader feeling enriched, and that spills out into the way they lead to their organization. I don't want to end on a sad note, but look at organizations like Boeing with the Max crisis, and where that rather than confront safety issues, it was more around scapegoating. And that resulted in the loss of hundreds of lives. So I don't think that this is just a topic that's a nice to have. I think it's a vital topic for leaders, and that every leader needs to be doing shadow work.
Absolutely. And thank you very much for your time today, Stephen. It was great to speak with you about Shadows at Work. And of course, I encourage our listeners to grab a copy to read more about what we discussed today and to really do the work on their shadows. So thank you very much for your time today. I really enjoyed discussing with you the book.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on LinkedIn, X, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcast.